The workers on the SP line to strike sent out a call. But Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and its drivers on the bum. And his engine and its bearings, they were all out of plumb. Casey Jones kept his junk pile running. Casey Jones was working double time. Casey Jones got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SP line. The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you better take a hike. Then someone threw a bunch of railroad ties across the track, and Casey hit the river with an awful crack. Casey Jones hit the river bottom. Casey Jones broke his bloomin' spine. Casey Jones became an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the SP line. When Casey Jones got up to heaven to the pearly gate, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that hauled the SP freight. You're just the man, said Peter, our musicians are on strike. You can get a job of scabbing anytime you like. Casey Jones got a job in heaven. Casey Jones was doing mighty fine. Casey Jones went scabbing on the angels, just like he did to workers on the SP line. The angels got together and they said it wasn't fair for Casey Jones to go around a scabbing everywhere. The Angels Union number 23, they sure were there, and they promptly fired Casey down the golden stair. Casey Jones went to hell a flying. Casey Jones, the devil said, oh fine. Casey Jones, get busy shoveling sulfur. That's what you get for scabbing on the SP line.
This is WOB Radio. This is a production of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. We are a union for all industries, and we also accept union members who are retired or who are incarcerated or who are young, old, and everyone in between. My name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I happen to be the branch secretary of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. I've also been our branch's delegate for a couple of years as well. So if you're interested in signing up to the union, you'll either get in contact with me or fellow worker Marilyn, who's also a delegate of the branch as well. I'm going to hand it off to Lynn over here on my right.
Hi, I'm Lynn, and I'm a participant in this radio show. Just wanted to explain that the IWW have been known as WOB. That's why we call it WOB Radio.
Wobbly is what we like to call fellow members of the IWW, because we like to quote-unquote wobble on the job. That is to agitate. I'm going to go ahead to my left.
My name's Eric. I've been with the IWW since August of last year, and I've been helping out with radio shows a little while after that. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Eric. Would you mind reading the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW?
More than happy. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people. The few who make up the have all the good. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. We find that the centering of management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions incapable or unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage war. Moreover, the trade unions aid in the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry or in all industries if necessary cease work whenever a strike or lockout in any department thereof, thus making it an injury to one, an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Thank you, Eric. Fellow worker Lynn, would you like to do a brief land acknowledgement for the Puyallup people?
I'd like to bring people's attention to the fact that we here in the Tacoma and surrounding areas in the Puget Sound are on tribal lands that have historically belonged to the Squaxin, the Nisqually, the Puyallup, the Centralia, Chehalis Native Americans, and we acknowledge them and are grateful to use their land.
Thank you. Going forward in our show today, we're just going to jump right into labor news, as we always do. Our first story is actually a really cool local story. This is a recent organizing campaign from UFCW 367.
What does that stand for?
I will give you the definition right now. So the UFCW is the United Food and Commercial Workers. And their local here, which is 367, just recently had a successful organizing campaign at the Marlene's grocery store. So have either of you been to Marlene's by chance?
Yes.
I have.
It's actually pretty nice. I've been there a couple of times before. Recently, they had come under ownership from an outside company. So an outside company bought the chain of Marlene's grocery stores here in the Pacific Northwest. An article from The Stand, which is a local newsletter. News about working people standing together in Washington State is their tagline. This article came out on February 25th. The workers at Marlene's Market and Deli in Tacoma won their election Friday to become the newest members of UFCW 367, per a post from the union on their Facebook page. We're proud to welcome them into the UFCW 367 family and will stand with them every step of the way as they fight for a strong first contract, said the union. Workers began organizing after the new Marlene's ownership made numerous concerning changes to working conditions, including reduced store hours and decreased paid time off. So they have just recently, basically, they won their union election. So Tuesday of last week, they finally won their union election after fighting to unionize their workplace. So congratulations to the Marlene's workers here in Tacoma. I know a few people who are part of UFCW 367. We actually have a couple of UFCW 367 members who are also Tacoma IWW members as well, and they have definitely recognized the union's capability for being able to get workers better wages, hours, and conditions. And we wish the best of luck to the Marlene's workers in negotiating their first contract coming up. And we will definitely keep you updated to all of our fellow listeners about that.
I will shop there more often now.
Yes, shop union, please. It definitely helps support workers who are organized. Our next article of labor news. This is something that we've reported on previously here on WAB Radio. I had recently brought news about Chavez Deremer, who is the potential new Secretary of Labor for the United States. She had a Senate hearing recently, basically to investigate her motives, her fitness to hold office. She is kind of an interesting contradiction within the Republican Party. She is a conservative who is also has historically been pro-labor and pro-union. I have an article here from Portside. Tagline is, material of interest to people on the left. They do a lot of labor-related reporting online. This article came out February 28th, 2025, written by Alex Nguyen for Mother Jones magazine. Trump appointee Lori Chavez Deremer found herself facing a tight committee vote Thursday morning, and just as a reminder, this article came out on the 28th, to head the Department of Labor. The question, was she too pro-worker for the job? Apparently not. On Thursday, the same Senate committee where the bill repeatedly died, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, HELP, voted to move forward her nomination to lead the Federal Labor Department. Senator Maggie Hassan, a Democrat from New Hampshire, Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, and John Hickenlooper, a Democrat from Colorado, joined Republicans in support, offsetting Senator Rand Paul's, the Republican from Kentucky, no vote. Democratic support in committee means Chavez Deremer will most undoubtedly pass the full Senate floor vote. So she's on her way to being approved by the Senate to head the Department of Labor. Going on further into the article, Chavez Deremer said she only backed the PRO Act to better represent her congressional district and to be part of the conversation in Congress about labor. Quote, I recognize that bill was imperfect, she told Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican from Louisiana, the chair of the HELP committee. Quote, if confirmed, my job will be to implement President Trump's policy decisions, and my guiding principle will be President Trump's guiding principle, ensuring a level playing field for businesses, unions, and most importantly, the American worker. So something that came out of these Senate committee hearings, the HELP committee hearings, was she was previously in favor of the PRO Act, which for our listeners would have been an act of Congress that would have significantly empowered labor unions and would have helped fight back against right-to-work laws and other legal hurdles for workers to organize into unions. Chavez de Remer had previously spoken out in support of that, but during her Senate committee hearing, she completely flipped and is now beginning to toe. She says she's going to help direct Trump on labor-related stuff, but seeing how Trump is handling the United States lately, I think has led a lot of people to skepticism. She might just end up kowtowing the line of whatever President Trump wants her to do in the world of labor. So,
you know that'll happen, yeah.
Yeah, it's a situation which definitely doesn't make me feel good.
His appointees, they just lie about what they won't do, what they will do. And the very first day they're in office, they take these draconian measures that are exactly the opposite of what they said they would or wouldn't do.
Or they'll just straight up, I mean, basically the Senate committee version of pleading the fifth. It kind of reminds me of when Trump was his previous administration, when he put three Supreme Court justices in the court, all of them were being questioned on like, hey, what's your opinion on Roe versus Wade or the recent gay marriage ruling? Or, you know, these other things that have been passed by the Supreme Court, because a lot of them were known to be very conservative in their interpretation of the Constitution, figuratively and literally. And a lot of them just kind of balked and basically said, I can't give any kind of comment on anything that isn't before me as a judge. And then they immediately went on to overturn Roe versus Wade. Yeah, these Senate committee hearings for a lot of Trump's appointees are beginning to feel the same way. They'll say one thing to get through the committee, and the second they're in power, they just...
Yeah, the first day, exactly. Unbelievable.
All right, moving on to our next news article here, and this is actually the last labor news story I have to report. This also has to do with the current Trump administration, because most of the news happening in this country right now is basically because of him and not in a good way. This is a statement from the APWU, that's the American Postal Workers Union, that's affiliated with the AFL-CIO. This was a statement by the APWU, by their president, Mark Dimenstein, on attacks to the public postal service. Now, those of you out there might be familiar with the fact that the postal service has tried to be privatized multiple times in this country's history, despite the fact that it is still a function of the government through the USPS. And this is a statement by the president of the union that represents the workers in the USPS.
It's still a joy running it, right? He was the Trump appointee, the general postmaster, right?
I believe so. I'm not sure if that was a previous administration.
I heard that he had fired him and that Trump was now in charge of it. But DeJoy swears he's still supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm. He's basically just the figurehead for the department right now, I think.
Weird, okay.
But this post, this statement actually directly addresses it.
Okay.
And this is a quote. The Washington Post has reported that the Trump administration will soon issue an executive order firing the Postal Board of Governors and placing the United States Postal Service under the control of the Commerce Department. If this reporting is true, it would be an outrageous, unlawful attack on a storied national treasure enshrined in the Constitution and created by Congress to serve every American home and business equally. Any attack on the Postal Service would be part of the billionaire oligarch coup directed not just at the postal workers our union represents, but the millions of Americans who rely on the critical public service our members provide every single day. The public postal service is the low-cost anchor of a 1.2 trillion mail and shipping industry, which supports more than 7 million jobs in communities across the country. Efforts to privatize the postal service, in whole or in part, or to strip it of its independence or public service mission would be no benefit to the American people. Instead, it would drive up postage rates and lead to reduced service, especially to rural America. Postal workers struck in 1970 to win collective bargaining rights and to rid the post office department of the political patronage that crippled the agency at the time. Going forward in the statement, the Washington Post also reported that the Board of Governors intends to fight this hostile takeover of the public postal service. The APWU supports their efforts to defend our national treasure. The Postal Service is owned by the people for the benefit of the people. Postal workers are dedicated to our mission to serve, no matter who sits in the White House or in Congress. Postal workers and our unions will join the public to fight for the vibrant, independent, and public postal service we all deserve. So once again, nothing ever changes in this country. The Postal Service might get privatized vis-a-vis the Department of Commerce.
They want to take over. I'm sure that their goal is to bust that union and to plunder their pensions.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I mean,
it's a big crunch of money.
I know that the postal workers, and my memory could be wrong on this, the postal workers have and can gone on strike previously. So if they wanted to strike because they didn't like how the administration was trying to privatize them, I imagine that the Trump administration is doing this to try and prevent that from happening.
And I bet you they're going to have a counter plan that probably, you know, like take really serious measures against the, you know, like they did in, I think it was Georgia, Atlanta, saying that the protesters were now part of the RICO, kind of going off some of the things that they've gotten the January 6th people on.
We're going to have another roundtable discussion here, as is our tradition on WAP Radio. And this is specifically talking about how, as fellow worker Lynn alluded to earlier in the show, how organized labor has responded to the Trump administration, either firing federal workers, many of whom are part of federal workers' unions, as well as the general attempted suppression of the labor movement in this country. Some of the actions that the Trump administration has already done, for example, we just mentioned how they might treat the postal workers in the future by trying to bust up their union. Also talked about the fact that the National Labor Relations Board does not have enough members on the board in order to actually have a quorum, which means that a lot of those people that Trump fired can't go to the NLRB and file unfair labor practice charges to potentially get their jobs back or get some kind of severance pay or benefits on the way out the door. And this is just kind of the first wave of what might happen to unions in this country. Chavez Dreamer, as we also previously mentioned in the labor news section, while she was kind of a hopeful for some in the trade union world, that even though she's a conservative, she's been historically pro-labor, and she might help stymie some of what Trump might do to unions, it sounds like she's flopping on that pretty quickly. We are kind of facing an interesting situation, and a lot of labor unions have been very adamant and very vocal about how they're going to fight back, and I wanted to kind of open that up as our discussion today. So if anyone would like to start, any thoughts?
I think it's definitely going to have to go, you know, the people and, or, you know, organizing and the unions, because I think at this point, at least for me personally, like, I have no more faith in either Democrats or Republicans. I'm almost 40 years old, and I've watched them say one thing and do another thing. And, you know, at some point, you just got to recognize that you're better doing it on your own, starting in your community and working your way up.
I can definitely sympathize with that. You know, I know that there are good-hearted progressives who stand out within the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has been, by and large, a very centrist organization. Whatever the Overton window of acceptable politics is, they try to stand right at the center to appeal to as many people as possible. And as the Republicans continue to move further and further to the right over the past decade, the Democratic Party has kind of shifted rightward on some certain issues as well to try and stay in the center. I mean, we saw with the Harris campaign, you know, she was trying to appeal to moderate conservatives by, for example, doing a speaking tour with Liz Cheney in order to try and win over some moderate conservatives who didn't like Trump from his first administration. That did not work at all. Mm-hmm. So I would like to think that the Democratic Party can mount some kind of offense. On the other hand, what kind of offense that they're waging right now has not been enough. There has been multiple articles, including from people within the Democratic Party, or quoted from within the Democratic Party, who say that they have really no organized resistance to what the Trump administration is doing. They have a majority in Congress, they have the entire executive branch, and the Supreme Court leans conservative. It's kind of a horrifyingly perfect predicament for them. Yeah, I mean, I've always had faith that labor unions can act as the arbiter of, maybe not the arbiter, but as the vehicle through which the working class can fight back. And I think the IWW definitely has a stake in that.
Kind of the guardrail.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You know, unions do have this kind of guardrail effect of whatever the bare minimum is legally permissible to happen to workers, the union always takes it an envelope further and says, no, we can have better than the minimum wage. We can have better than the legally base amount of benefits that we're allowed to provide, even when some of those benefits don't exist legally at all. For example, maternity leave is something that is not guaranteed by the federal government. On the other hand, speaking as a dual carder, because I also happen to be a member of Teamsters 117 here locally in the Puget Sound area, I am a little concerned that the trade unions are only just now beginning to wake up to the fact that the conservative factions, especially within their officers and administration, may not have their best interests in mind. This was something that was especially pertinent with the Teamsters because the president of the Teamsters, Sean O'Brien, and allegedly the executive board of the union essentially basically said, we recognize that from our online internal polling of union members, a good chunk of them, a slim majority of them, apparently supported Trump. There were some issues with those statistics. As you can imagine, the only people who feel very fervently about their politics are going to actually participate in a poll in the first place. And it's also countered by the fact that almost every single local in this country voted to endorse Harris, and district councils of the Teamsters across the country voted to endorse Harris when the president and the executive board basically said, we're not going to endorse anyone because we don't want to be controversial. Sean O'Brien is like having lunch with Trump in Mar-a-Lago and trying to say that the Democrats have completely lost the plot on the working class, which, yes, but Trump is not the alternative to that. So, I don't know. The trade unions have, kind of like the Democratic Party, been scrambling with the situation of, on one hand, organized labor is going to suffer under a right-wing administration. On the other hand, there's a good chunk of our union membership that's fairly right-wing, and we don't want to make them mad. So they're kind of caught in the crosshairs of everything.
Well, at this point, too, like from what I've gathered, my brother, my roommate who I live with, he watches quite a bit of news, and there's a lot of people that, are finally starting to understand the idea of tariffs. And, they vote for one thing, and then, when it finally comes down, they're like, oh, wait, that's affecting me. I'm a farmer. That's affecting me. I'm a small business owner. It's like, well, I mean.
I think, a lot of his voters are really being hurt. They're postal workers. They're government workers. They're just people, and millions of them. Just can imagine that they take your job away. You got no income for the next month or so, mm-hmm. and you got no health insurance all of a sudden. You might have just moved there. It's expensive to move. I mean, just uprooting people's lives. And then their child care, they don't need child care, so then the child care place folds. I mean, there's so many consequences to these cruel things that are being done.
It's dangerous and self-harming to our society as a whole.
Absolutely. Taking away early childhood education kind of stuff. They cut that off, I guess, immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we don't invest in children, I'm a non-parent, but you got to invest in our schools and in our children if you want educated. But that's the question, is some people might not want educated people.
Right. And considering the fact that the Trump administration is also literally spitballing the idea of destroying the Department of Education and just abolishing it as a function of the government is buck wild to me, and also would significantly affect teachers' unions in this country. Because then how would the teachers' unions would probably bargain with whatever the local school administration is. But again, having a government agency that can help direct education and funding and the standards of education that we have in this country, yeah, it's pretty grim for them.
And they vary a lot from state to state.
Very mm-hmm. true.
I would definitely say the unions that I'm seeing right now really kind of lead the fight with the Trump administration is, A, any of the unions that have state or federal workers who might come under threat from the Trump administration, especially with a lot of those layoffs, those are the people who have kind of been front of the line being like, hey, you've illegally fired these people, or you haven't fired these people through due process. And even though we can't file a ULP, an unfair labor practice charge, through the National Labor Relations Board, we're still going to take you to task on it. I think I've also seen a lot of sympathy online for parks workers and forestry workers and environmental workers. Because, I mean, some of these people, there's a good chunk of them who are, like, young, who had just gotten into, like, being a park ranger or doing parks maintenance and stuff like that. And they're very passionate about doing works for the National Park Service, for example, and then just getting completely laid off without a charge. I've seen a lot of protests outside of national parks all across the country of fired workers being like, we used to work here and the current administration is going to destroy what you enjoy as a public good, and we are the victims of that. And I think that that has a very powerful effect of, you know, if you're driving into a national park and you're seeing a bunch of fired workers with picket signs alongside the road, it kind of makes you think twice about going to that park or looking over the fact that these are controlled by an administration that is not friendly to its workers. As for the other major trade unions, again, the Teamsters is in a weird situation. A lot of the Teamsters I know personally are not a fan of the president of the union at the time. I think Scab is his current nickname within some ranks of the Teamsters union. The UAW, and this is a headline I've seen recently, even though I don't have an exact source in front of me right now. The UAW president is Sean Fain. And Sean Fain has been very, very vocal against Trump and the current presidential administration. And he's also done, a good job chastising the Democrats by basically saying, who exactly are you supporting and what are you doing to support them right now? Because again, like I've mentioned earlier, the Democrats do not seem to have any kind of unified strategy against this. They've admitted it outright. On the other hand, the UAW president also, he was quoted in an article a couple of weeks ago, or at least shortly after Trump got into office and was inaugurated in. He said something along the lines of, you know, we're willing to try and work with the Trump administration as much as possible, but we're going to keep fighting for the workers. And for a second there, it's kind of like, are you going to become another Sean O'Brien? Please don't become another Sean O'Brien. You're like the one good, notable person in organized labor who's like noteworthy and recognizable right now. Please do not become O'Brien. And thankfully, he did backtrack that and basically take the Trump administration to task, which I appreciate. I know that we kind of have a, I know that we have a couple fellow workers who aren't able to join us today, fellow worker Gordon, fellow worker Marilyn. And I know that I'm sure that they would have thoughts about this conversation as well, because they have also worked within, you know, trade unions and would probably also be able to give a perspective on this as well. But I think, and again, this is kind of me speaking as an IWW member here, I noticed that in times of crisis, for example, during the COVID-19 pandemic, when it was at its height between 2020 and 2021, a lot of people came to the IWW because they said, I either like the union I'm a part of, but I want something better, or, oh my God, everything is going to crap. We need to I need to become part of a, you know, local organization that I can help kind of be a part of that change. And for me, being involved in my union, especially the IWW, has really lessened the blow of the everything that is happening in this country. I you know, when Trump got elected, I definitely panicked. I was like, oh crap, here we go. But on the other hand, I was kind of like, I'm already doing the activism that I would be doing under this kind of administration, under an administration that is becoming more capital F fascist by the day. And, you know, I think that being involved in your union or your local, you can definitely kind of help fight back against these kinds of situations. So I think another part of the conversation about how unions can push back against everything that the Trump administration is doing, or really anything anti-labor in the future, something I keep thinking about is the fact that the suffragette movement or the civil rights movement or the labor movement were really founded on the idea of, we need to push back against what the law is and be willing to break those laws if necessary. I understand labor law because I kind of have to, you know, being the branch secretary and also making sure that whatever campaigns we do get involved with for organizing workplaces, that those are within the law. But on the other hand, I think a big question that needs to be asked is, can the unions in this country really find the bravery to push back against labor law as it currently exists, or push back against the illegal firing of federal workers by the Trump administration, or push back against any kind of anti-labor legislation or action that might come in the future, wherever it happens, right? You know, the IWW very firmly believes an injury to one, an injury to all. But if we can't actually make that possible because we're constrained by labor law, then what can exactly can we do? This is something I've also mentioned on a previous episode about, you know, the environmentalist movement. They didn't stop at protesting. They went as far as to take direct action. Of course, the labor movement and the IWW especially believes in direct action as well. But what is going to be, as some people have phrased it, the South Bank of the Rubicon. What will be the one step taken too far before trade unions bring back that radical aspiration of, we're going to take action whether or not the law says it's okay? And frankly, I have a lot of doubts that some of the people in the trade unions can even make that happen now.
Yeah, that's been a concern of mine for a while, too. It's like, how far will you bend before you snap back? And what, you know, at this point in particular, it's like, you know, how much more are we going to take?
I fear martial law. If everybody gets really, really active and there's quite a movement, can you see that? I'm just declaring that.
Well, there's an interesting modern parallel there, because South Korea just had a period of martial law. So yeah, it was the 2024 South Korean martial law crisis from December 3rd to December 4th. And basically the reason why it happened, and this is an article from AP News from back in December, the South Korean president declared martial law for the period of a day from December 3rd to December 4th. And he used the allegation of there are anti-state forces within the government who were trying to essentially challenge his authority and power in order to try and, you know, embed himself into his office even further. And within the period of a day, he enacted martial law, which has a long and storied history of happening multiple times in South Korean history. But within the day, legislators were jumping over security fences. They were pushing past people in the military and the police to get back into essentially their national legislature in order to vote to repeal martial law and also to press impeachment charges against the president.
And thousands of people turned out on the streets.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, people were literally taking weapons out of the hands of special forces officers, or yeah, special forces members and officers, and they eventually gave them back, but essentially wrested their way back into government buildings and government functionaries in order to stop the martial law from happening. I think it occurred over a literal period of hours. It began and it ended, and it happened quickly. People mobilized, citizens mobilized in the streets. Legislators were hopping over the fence to get back into the legislature building to vote to undo the enactment of martial law because they had to be in the building in order to vote on it. Mm-hmm. And they repealed it. Now look at the United States. The only major opposition party right now is completely fumbling the bag on how to do anything to meaningfully stop Trump. The most progressive members of the Democratic Party are explicitly stating outright, coming from an insider, the party has no specific or directed plan to stop anything that's happening. To respond to Lynn, I don't think martial law would even be necessary. The incompetence of whatever opposition there is kind of allowing them to do whatever they want for the time being. We do have midterm elections to look forward to, but the remaining 2 years that we have until the midterm elections, anything can happen.
Well, and the judiciary is really a slow process, and some of the upper courts and Supreme Court can facilitate them, you know, speed them up, but it's which ones they choose to and which ones they don't, because they have done that at different times. But a lot of them, they'll just let them go, or they'll say, well, we'll decide next Monday or something. It's very, very frustrating how slowly it moves when it goes to, like, the ultimate.
It doesn't help the fact also that Trump has threatened to fire a bunch of the judges. I think he's actually in the process of getting rid of a bunch of the judges that were appointed by Biden, and the Supreme Court is completely stacked in a very conservative direction. So even from the judicial perspective, things are kind of already the way Trump wants it to be. And I know that I used a phrase earlier on this episode. The South Bank of the Rubicon refers to ancient Roman history. It's basically used as a phrase to ask the question, what's the final straw that's going to take you to do something far more direct and far more radical? What does the South Bank of the Rubicon look like to you? Whether that's mass deportations and immigration roundups, whether that's LGBT people beginning to face more direct violence as a result of everything that the Trump administration is empowering, whether that's labor unions being completely defanged and gutted of their legal ability to do any kind of organizing. I would encourage our listeners to ask that question as an individual. What is your South Bank of the Rubicon? This is something that a YouTuber, Innuendo Studios, actually did a full video on. I highly recommend that you watch it. He puts it in a much better way than I can.
How can a person find it?
You can look up Innuendo Studios on YouTube.com.
Okay.
He has his own channel on there. But yeah, and you know, I kind of look at the trade unions right now and I'm kind of like, well, what's your South Bank of the Rubicon? Because there's all this other awful stuff that's happening, to be sure. And the labor unions can do anything to directly respond to it. And even though there has been a huge upsurge in workplace organizing recently, and I would like to think there's a kind of a progressive or radical edge coming back to the bigger trade unions, I'm wondering if that's going to be enough. Because again, all of them are incentivized to operate within the boundaries of whatever labor law says is acceptable. You won't find trade union officers advocating for something like secondary strikes or sit-down strikes or boycotts or even wildcat strikes, because those are all illegal. If they can't approve of them, and even if they did, they would face severe repercussions from the government. But are they willing to break the law in order to save organized labor is the real question. I think that considering the radical history of it, yeah, I think a lot of people, even in the IWW, would definitely be willing to say, yeah, I'd be willing to break labor law if it meant I could, you know, galvanize my coworkers to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. Even if we do face the consequences, we'll bail each other out of jail. We'll go in front of whatever's left of the NLRB and state our case. But it's a question we also have to ask ourselves as well. Because if the Department of Labor gets gutted, if the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, continues to remain inoperative, we kind of have no other choice. And I think that that's going to be our South Bank of the, where's the South Bank of the Rubicon question. How bad does organized labor have to get until the rank and file start taking charge of their unions again, the trade unions in specific, and start to turn the boat the other direction? I don't think it probably would take something like martial law, quite frankly, something that draconian and totalitarian. But I think that the South Bank of the Rubicon should be a little closer than that, in my opinion.
I'm just kind of reminded, it's what drew me to the IWW, is that, you know, we've gotten results in the past, and it's not by doing what you're told. And, you know, I guess for me, in my personal opinion, laws are merely suggestions. And the fact that the people that create these suggestions are the rich bureaucrats that hold the monopoly on violence. And I don't, you know, that just doesn't sit right with me. I think people should be able to take care of themselves and take care of their own communities and not rely on class traders or police to do that for them. So for me, it was just, you know, the IWW actually being able to take care of its workers based upon, like, what I've read about the Seattle 1919 strike and stuff like that. You know, it's up to us to take care of ourselves. We need to stop looking up to these quote unquote leaders, you know, because, you know, you have more in common with your neighbor than you do any politician or billionaire.
Absolutely. I also like to phrase it, you have more likelihood of being, and therefore more likelihood in finding solidarity with someone who's homeless rather than someone that you...
100%, yeah. So yeah, I'm hoping at some point people find their conscience and, you know, do the right thing, you know?
Especially the senators.
Ugh. I mean, even if they had a conscience, the Democrats have a minority in both the House and the Senate. I mean, we're talking like two or three votes worth of difference.
Of course, that's right. But just those Republicans on such important candidates, they just should have not approved. Just, oh my God.
Yeah, and I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not the biggest cheerleader of the Democratic Party. And of course, the IWW doesn't espouse any political affiliations, but... You know, I think that's actually kind of another part of the conversation, too, is that the way trade unions have these political endorsements or affiliations and whatnot, I think has kind of hampered them to a certain degree, because the IWW doesn't espouse political affiliation. We don't endorse parties. We don't endorse candidates. Mm-hmm. It's constitutionally, for us, forbidden. Whereas the trade unions have always tried to get politicians to be more friendly towards organized labor, or at the very least espouse quote-unquote pro-working class values, as long as the unions still have some protections. And I think the jig might be up on that, because, again, a lot of the trade unions have historically endorsed Democrats because Democrats like to position themselves as the party of the working class, even though that image has faltered in some places to a degree. And even though the Democrats are vocally pro-labor, they have not done legislatively enough to protect labor unions and to try and make them as strong as they are again. So I almost kind of wonder if the trade union's association with politics has finally come back to bite them in a way, because now the party that they have for a long time endorsed as being able to represent their interests and represent working people's interests is floundering at doing anything to stop this union busting and these illegal firings at all. I can only wonder if trade unions might change their feelings on that as a result of everything that's happening now.
It's just an emergency how fast they're moving. Every day, a different department, a different group. I mean, our food safety, so many nuclear power people that repair. Unbelievable that they defang the air traffic controllers.
Mm-hmm.
What?
And we remember what happened to the air traffic controllers during the PATCO strike in 1981. When they went on strike, Ronald Reagan, famous conservative president Ronald Reagan, fired them all and essentially used the military to scab on them.
Mm-hmm.
And it completely devastated the organized power of air traffic controllers at the time. It wasn't until a completely brand new union was formed and negotiated with the federal government that a lot of those air traffic controllers were organized again. And now a bunch of them have been threatened, if not already laid off, by the Trump administration. So it's kind of a PATCO situation without the strike even happening.
They're already short-staffed, you know, and I mean, we all fly. Don't we want to be sure that it's the safest possible?
Yeah, I mean, I've been invited by my family to take a flight out of country to go on vacation later this year, but honestly, I'm personally terrified of getting in an airplane at this point because flight attendants are having a harder and harder time trying to keep passengers complicit with safety rules and being polite, just to be frank, on a very long flight. And now the air traffic controllers are overworked and they have a complete staff shortage. And I don't want to get in a plane anymore. I'll take me by boat. I'd rather be on the Titanic than get on a plane right now, because at least the Titanic has lifeboats.
Bold.
Yeah.
There's a little hope. Very little, but if there's, yeah.
I mean, there is a little hope. There is a little hope with what's going on in this country. And again, the reason why I personally have not been so overwhelmed or completely disaffected by everything that the Trump administration has and will do is the fact that I'm kind of already doing the activism I would be doing regardless. I still believe that labor unions have a chance to address what's happening in this country very aggressively, very much led by the rank and file, and in a very direct way. The question is, especially in the larger trade unions, the AFL-CIO unions, are the union officers and administrators and lawyers going to be willing to step to the side to let that happen? I have my doubts, because they've always wanted to play strictly within the bounds of the law. They have not been very aggressive, quite frankly, about pursuing greater legal rights for workers and for unions, even though they campaign on it. You know, depending on what union you're in or in what local you're a part of, the level of democracy and rank and file control you have can vary. You might not exactly have a say over everything that the executive board or the local board of directors or whatever does. And I think that the labor aristocracy or the labor bureaucracy is going to have to break in order for the rank and file to be able to fight back against the Trump administration, plain and simple. And that's not me shading any particular labor union president or even the particular labor union officer who might be hearing this, but there is kind of an issue of the trade unions trying to play nice and try to play by the rule book that they have been handed by politicians that is explicitly set up to only protect the flow of commerce. I mean, that's how the Wagner Act starts. The first sentence of the first major piece of federal legislation in this country, perhaps the most powerful piece of labor legislation in this country, that allowed for the legal right of unions to organize, the first sentence, it says, this is an act to protect the flow of commerce. And that's how everything labor law related is framed in this country. And of course, under the Trump administration, it's not even going to be about the unions. It's just going to be about the commerce. So, yeah. I think that the unions have an opportunity, but they do need to challenge themselves to be willing to take the risk again.
Mm-hmm.
Even within the IWW, I think a lot of us, you know, they cling on to that radical heritage that the IWW has handed us and say, yeah, we would be willing to do direct action. We would be willing to violate labor law. But I think even a lot of us might be a little bit scared about it as well.
And I think looking towards ways to expand on that and figure out a way to get people to take the little actions that matter, I think is should be of concern to me as well.
This is Marilyn, and usually I talk about environmental justice. And I'm going to do that today, but I have something else I want to talk about too, because the two are related and I want to tie them in together. March is the International Month for Women, and March 8th is the International Day of Women. And I know you all have heard about that, but a little brief history. The purpose of it is to promote equity and equality and eliminate violence against women. It's celebrated on March 8th, but the very first women's march occurred in 1908 in New York City to demand voting rights and better working conditions. In 1909, the Socialist Party of the United States also did their first women's march. And in 1910, a woman named Claire Zetkin, who was a German activist, brought it to Europe. And in that year, it was first celebrated also in Germany, Denmark, Austria, and Switzerland. So at that point, it became international. In 1917, the Russian women marched, and they were marching because of food shortages and World War I. In 1921, the date was officially switched to June 8th, because before then, it had pretty much been all over the map. Finally, in 1975, the United Nations officially started commemorating the National Day of Women. So when you think about it, it's not that long ago. Mm-hmm. Now, we all know that there are wonderful women that have done amazing things. I'm going to focus on just a few that have been active in the environmental justice movement and also, to a certain extent, civil rights and women's rights. I did a little research because I have trouble remembering names, no matter how amazing they are. But we can start with Fannie Lou Hamer. She founded the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and she is famous for her quote, "I'm sick and tired of feeling sick and tired."
I've heard that one before.
Yeah. So, just an indomitable woman. She suffered terrible beatings in jail. She was born in Mississippi in 1917. Then, and you all have heard of her. Moving along, there is, and very close to the IWW person's heart, Mother Jones, who was born Mary Harris. And she worked very hard for the United Mine Workers and to fight against child labor, which is huge. And I'm not going to go into that too much. You can look her up. Coming along to more recent times, I absolutely had to mention two people. Arundhati Roy, who is a prodigious writer, and if you haven't read The God of Small Things and The Ministry of Utmost Happiness, you must do it. She has been fighting against injustice in India and the caste system, Modi's government, forever. And then there is Vandana Shiva. Now we're getting into the area of environmental justice. This is another woman from India. She is a physicist and a scientist and also received the Right Livelihood Award, which is an alternative to the Nobel Peace Prize. Her passions were, she saw what was happening to the farmers in India. She saw what the GMO scam was doing to them and resulting in loss of land and suicides. The farmers, of course, had been used to saving seed, but you can't save seed with GMO. And it was just devastating them. So she has been fighting against big tech and big agriculture and social justice just forever. She's a hero of mine. This year, the Right Livelihood Award has gone to several women. One of them is Annabella Lemos. She is from Mozambique, and she has been fighting against corporate projects that lead to community displacement. And if that's not environmental, I don't know what is. Then there is, Joan Carling. She's from the Philippines. She's a Filipino who is fighting for indigenous global ecology because it's breaking down and, again, displacing and impoverishing communities. It's an organization called the Evergreen Resistance Fighting for Climate Justice in Cambodia. So that's another one that you can look up if you need to. What I want to cut to the chase about is that women have always been protectors of the home. And of course, biologically, they spawn the kids. So they have always been protectors of children, struggling to provide food for their children in a healthy environment. Many of them are truck gardeners or home gardeners, or even raising animals and crops to sell in the markets to support their children. They are on the front lines of what is happening to our environment. And of course, a huge component of that is indigenous people all over the world. Now, in our own backyard, we have Ramona Bennett, who has fought for Indian rights. We have Winona LaDuke, and she has been fighting for food sovereignty for the Great Lakes region and the wild rice, being able to harvest their wild rice with unpolluted water by pipelines. It's interesting because women's rights intersect almost all rights. Without a livable environment, we have nothing. And without protecting that environment, we have nothing, especially now.
Absolutely.
Especially now. So now more than ever, we need to celebrate the women and the men and everybody else who is working to preserve the environment and human rights all over the world.
Coming towards the close of our show today and concluding our roundtable discussion, we just wanted to leave off the show with some local announcements, some previous events that we've attended, as well as upcoming events that we would like to invite the public to attend, because we are certainly going to be there, the IWW. Just as a brief update, I know that we've mentioned his legal case on the radio show before, but Leonard Peltier, the longtime American Indian Movement activist who has been imprisoned for decades on trumped up charges of participating in a police shootout, has finally been released back to his tribe, back to his family. He is on house arrest, so he does have certain legal limitations, but former President Biden did successfully commute his sentence, and he is finally free. The IWW will be sending a letter to him and his family soon, drafted by our branch membership in solidarity with his efforts and ongoing indigenous organizing efforts.
Is he still in? Does there still have to be paperwork and stuff, or is he out now?
He's out now. Okay. Yeah, he's recently been released to his family.
I was thinking you said something about it. It made me think that there still had to be administrative stuff done before. Yeah, I knew that they decided to let him commute.
Does anyone have any events that they've attended recently that they'd like to talk about on air?
Well, I'm a recent member of the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, for those who know, the Bernie Sanders Party. They had a local convention, and I went to that, but I don't really have anything to report back. There were different speakers, and I didn't really get the, because I didn't stay the whole time. But I'm happy to be part of that organization. There's a lot of overlap between that and the IWW and other groups that I'm involved in.
I actually do have an upcoming event I'd like to announce to our listenership. Some of you might have heard that up in Seattle, there is a Seattle Labor Chorus, and they sing labor songs and protest songs and stuff like that. Mm. From people from a bunch of different unions. You can reach out to them. They actually have a Facebook page, which is just Seattle Labor Chorus. They have an event coming up in a little more than a month from now called Undaunted We Sing, a concert to inspire hope and action. That is going to be taking place Sunday, April 27th from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. And it's going to be at 5030 First Avenue South in Seattle. So that's coming up later in April, but I have heard the work of the Seattle Labor Chorus. They do public performances of labor songs, protest songs, and they kind of keep that singing tradition alive for the labor movement here locally.
Oh,
I personally thought about auditioning myself because I used to be a part of the Puget Sound Christmas Rebels, or it was called the Christmas Rebels back then. And I've always wanted to start singing in a chorus again. So I might have to tap them on the shoulder and remind them that, you know, a lot of the labor songs you're singing are actually from the IWW. So we legally have bragging rights. We don't copyright them. You can use them. But I think it would be fun to attend that. I've heard good things about the Seattle Labor Chorus.
That sounds like a great idea. Everybody could use a little bump of positivity and compassion at this point.
Yeah, sounds like a cool thing.
If there's any fellow listeners out there who want to get more involved with the IWW, either here in Tacoma or in Seattle or in Olympia or out in the Kitsap County area, we do have organizer trainings coming up at multiple IWW branches here across the Puget Sound. If you're interested in attending an organizer training here with the IWW, feel free to reach out to us at tacoma@iww.org. We essentially teach you how to organize your workplace by learning how to talk to your coworkers. So actually, a recent event that the Tacoma IWW hosted was an OT101 training. Now, the OT101 is our organizer training for workers who want to organize their workplaces. We have multiple quality trainers all across the country who come into local branches to teach anyone who's interested, typically in about classes of anywhere from 10 to 25 people, to learn how to talk to your coworkers about wages, hours, and benefits, talk to what's personally affecting them in their workplace, you know, learn how to encourage greater group participation and thinking about taking actions on those issues collectively. We cover labor law and how to organize your workplace in a way that is respective of labor law so that you can organize right and have a successful organizing campaign in your workplace. We also go over fun activities like how to collectively confront your employer, for example. That was actually something really fun that we did in our recent OT101 training. That was just a barrel of laughs. But yeah, we basically teach you how to organize your workplace and the steps and actions that you can take in order to have a union with your coworkers. Now, I don't have a list of current OT101s in front of me. However, I, as the branch secretary for the Tacoma IWW, have spoken with other branches here locally in the Puget Sound. We're going to have multiple OT101s regionally this year at all of these branches of the IWW. So if you're interested in learning how to organize and unionize your workplace, we will teach you, and we will teach you for free. That's the best part. And yes, lunch and breakfast is included. So feel free to reach out to the Tacoma branch through our email, tacoma@iww.org, and we can get you set up with an OT101 so you can learn how to organize your workplace today. We want to thank everybody for tuning in and listening. Again, this is WOB Radio, a production of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, a union of all industries. We would also like to thank our fellow broadcasters for hosting our show, 101.9 KTAH LPFM here in Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, which is also here in Tacoma, and 94.9 KZAX, which is our broadcaster up in downtown Bellingham. We would like to thank you for carrying our show and broadcasting it in the working class communities that we hope to reach out to and empower. If you are interested in reaching out to the Tacoma IWW General Membership Branch, you can reach out to us at tacoma@iww.org. We also have a Facebook page, and we also have an Instagram page as well. If you send a direct message to either one of those social media pages, you will get in contact with either a delegate of the branch or myself, the branch secretary, and we can show you in the direction of how to start organizing your workplace for better wages, hours, and conditions. Or if you just want to help out in some other aspect of the union, we'll be happy to point you in the right direction. So please reach out to us. We would certainly appreciate your membership and your participation in helping fight for better labor rights and better working conditions in this country. Thank you to all of you once again for tuning in, and solidarity.
Solidarity.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.